kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
This is Indeed Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Last weekend, the first annual Chicago Podcast Festival took to stages around the city, and this week on the show, our set recorded live at Shuba's Tavern.
Great venue, great crowd. And the Chicago Tribune's Michael Phillips joined us for the top five movies that console and restore hope.
Our effort to promote a little holiday cheer in the wake of what has been a tough year, not just here in the States, but around the world. It's all ahead on Film Spotting. It's Thanksgiving week here in the States, Josh. We're recording this a little earlier in the week, but we want to wish a happy Thanksgiving to listeners out there celebrating with family or just celebrating with us. Do you have big plans?
We have it easy this year. Usually we do host Thanksgiving for Debbie's whole family, which is a pretty big group, but this year it's at her sister's. So just going to, maybe I'll help out with some dishes, but other than that, I don't have any responsibilities.
That's funny because it's the exact opposite for me. We've never hosted Thanksgiving, and my entire family is in Chicago and is coming to our house.
What's the head count on that?
It's going to be, I think, when it's all said and done, around 16 or 17.
Good luck.
At my house, at least half of those, if not more, kids.
Young, yes.
So I may be dipping into the wine a little earlier than normal. We'll see how that goes. The rest of the show you're about to hear was recorded last Friday night as part of the first annual Chicago Podcast Festival. We want to thank Jonathan Pitts and the great Tyler Green, who usually produces our live shows. He was the artistic director of this event. We want to thank them for putting on the podcast festival and for featuring us. We did have a great time. We got to hang out with Matt and Allison, of course, from Film Spotting SVU, and they shared some of their picks for cinematic comfort food right now that may be needed by some people, appropriate with Thanksgiving too, I suppose. And we got some great audience contributions as well.
The audience was really lively. It was fun to sit in the audience for Matt and Allison's show and watch them do their thing. And yeah, I wouldn't have expected for our section of the night that we would have gotten a Showgirls reference.
Right.
But that came in as one listener suggesting, I guess that's a movie that restores hope. Was that
Spencer Coyle?
Yeah.
I think is his name. Yeah. So. And yeah, I actually took a photo while he was talking on stage just because I wanted to get the crowd perspective. I wanted one shot of the crowd looking back at us. And it actually came out really great. And it's fun to look at and see a packed house at Shuba's all having a great time. And they were just there to listen to the three of us on stage talk about movies. So it was a great night overall. We think the show went really well. I guess you guys who weren't there will be the judge of that as we actually get into the audio. The top five we chose for this show was movies that console and restore hope. And it is a top five, believe us or not. And after you hear the content of the show, you really may not want to believe that it wasn't inspired by the election. But we settled on this list well over a month ago. We were just anticipating the end of a long and unpleasant campaign season here in the U.S. And of course, things haven't really gotten any less contentious since November 8th.
No, but it was June, right, when we first heard about this idea. It was suggested by listener Dennis Carpentier. He tweeted us in response, actually, to the mass shooting that took place in Orlando, where 49 lives were lost. So that's just one of the instances that has made 2016 a tough year for so many of us. And we thought at the time that was a good idea. We took Dennis's suggestion and have been thinking about it. It's been in the back of our minds well before the results of the election. And obviously, it turned a little bit more to directly address that when it came time to putting together our lists.
Absolutely. Despite the frustration and anger or despair that may have inspired such a list, it did make for what we felt was a really fun top five, hopefully a fairly provocative top five as well, and undoubtedly, as we said, a really fun show. Let's get to it.
So who's been here to one of our year-end wrap parties? Okay. So that's one of those shows. It's kind of a big deal, you know. There's clips. There's a lot of sound. We've got an improvising musician on stage with Adam and Josh. Lots of guests. It's a lot of fun, but it's a lot of stress. We look forward to it. The next one's already penciled in. In fact, Friday, January 13th. You can get tickets now. But that's just to say that we were looking forward to this. I know Adam and Josh and I were all looking forward to this being very casual, very intimate, no AV to juggle, no sound, no clips. And so we were just thinking about how much fun we would be. And the illusion of how much fun that would be ended last night at 7:30 when I got a text from Adam, who was having a panic attack on the way home from work. And because I'm his podcast wife, he came to me and he knew he could count on me to make him much, much more upset, which I think I succeeded in doing. But so before we get to their top five movies that restore hope and console, I want you all to help console and restore hope to Adam, who has a panic attack because he loves you, because he loves this. Let's hear it for Josh and Adam and Michael Phillips.
So Sam got a little too eager, which is what we love about him. Not totally set up here.
Give us a minute.
Well, I'm ready. No.
Michael's always ready. Are we actually ready for this?
This almost didn't happen. I know we're tight for a time, but should we share the crisis we had beforehand?
I knew you would.
We had a vest crisis.
Yes.
I knew he'd wear one. And I'm wearing one.
I was told we haven't coordinated outfits ever for a live show.
No.
And it's been okay. We've gotten away with that. So earlier this week, I was told not to wear a vest. And I pictured Adam in a vest. And I thought, okay, I guess I can see that. I won't wear a vest. So I came into my kind of a bulky, I'm not wearing it, as you can see, kind of a bulky fall winter weather vest. And he comes out of the green room and says, "What's with the vest?"
He doesn't know what a vest is, apparently.
I took it off so that he could wear this vest. And I think he looks wonderful, doesn't he?
Yeah, that's kind of you. I'm heading to Aspen right after this taping, so just so everyone knows.
Who are you wearing? Eddie Bauer's one.
Pretty much. With that out of the way, let's let the healing begin.
Yes.
Are we ready, everybody? So, first of all, just, again, a quick round of applause for Matt and Allison. So great to have them here, all the way from New York. So we are going to do a top five, and they focused on cinematic comfort food, which, if I was doing that top five list, I'd just watch Rio Bravo and Dazed and Confused on repeat forever. But that's not how I approached this list. I can't wait to hear how you guys approach this list. So, Michael, we're just going to jump into it. We're going to start with you. Tell us how you did form any criteria, if you did, and tell us your number five pick.
If you go on something like IMDb, and you'll see categories like movies that feel good, movies that restore your faith in humanity, Forrest Gump, Slumdog Millionaire, whatever. This is not, to me, that's the kind of renewal in humanity and hope that Hollywood, you know, spends too much time trying to process into this cheese whiz that we'll buy, you know. So I'm going for a different sort of thing. I think I'm just looking for movies that, at this particular moment in our history, that give me the kind of hope that, it's not necessarily even the happiest endings out there. It's really just more like a hard-won, bittersweet, mixed bag of an ending. You know, that's, and to me, that's reaching across the aisle. You know, that's. But my number five is a film I've been yakking about since it came out, and now by now a lot of people have seen this film, John Kearney's film Once. This is the Dublin romance, not really quite a romance, between these two street musicians, Glenn Hansard of the Frames and the Czech emigre Markéta Erglova. This is a film that just has a kind of a quality that it feels like it just happened. The movie just sort of happened, and it's a small film, and John Kearney, in the interview I did with him at Sundance when I first saw it, was completely self-effacing. He says, "Oh, the whole thing is, the writing is just shite. It's just shite, shite." And it's like, I said, "John, it's not shite. It's not, you know," and that's one of the few films, I guess you could call it a musical, but it's one of the few films that had that sort of hold your breath quality toward 15 minutes toward the end. It's like, they're not going to blow it, are they? They're actually going to find the right note of kind of romantic wisdom, hope, everything. It's all mixed up in one. And for a film about two people that don't get together, it sent me out on a cloud, you know? And to me, that's the kind of renewal and hope I look for right now. So that's my number five.
Yeah, Kearney's
Thank you. Good pick.
Thank you so much.
Cardi's Sing Street was mentioned, I think, as a... Yeah. I think it was listener Dave Coletta, might be here on Twitter, mentioned that as a possibility. And I know, Adam, it was in the running for one of your favorite films. I finally caught up with it and agree that it's fantastic and can see Carney has maybe that touch to be able to hit those sort of notes genuinely, you know, which I think is what you're talking about, where Hollywood tries to squeeze them out. We're looking for the movies where they flow genuinely.
Right. And I might even argue with you on Sing Street because it's a totally different kind of ending. It's like a ridiculous, improbable, happy ending that works for a lot of people.
I'm glad you're between us right now.
This rap party
has... I'm going to take my vest off in a second. And
all right. Rap party could be fun if we throw down at best of your time. Okay. So my number five... I'm going with a somewhat obscure documentary, one that I saw at the Toronto International Film Festival in 2015, I think. It's called In Jackson Heights. This is Frederick Wiseman's, it's 190 minutes, and it's this comprehensive portrait of one Queens neighborhood, and they just detail the day-to-day work of democracy. Is essentially what this catalogs. There's a lot of extended, very lightly edited scenes of things like community planning sessions or even activist meetings. And this is the sort of stuff when I started out as a news reporter, I had to go to these things and I hated them. You know, I'm looking at my watch all the time. I just wanted to get out of there. So why did this documentary, years later, 3 hours plus, hold me in thrall? And I should probably confess, because I was at TIFF with my dad, who I think is here tonight. I did step out to take a phone call from home in the 3 hours. So, but I came back and wanted to come back. And the question is, why did the movie with this material hold me? And I think partly it's because of Wiseman's patient camera. It has a lot to do to it. But what seemed important to me then, and even more so now, is that Jackson Heights is one of the most diverse neighborhoods on the planet. Many of the people portrayed here are recent immigrants. So we watch them trying to build a life. And what do we see, Adam? You're going to like this. They get the job done. That's what this movie captures. And even as challenges arise, that might be life as an undocumented person. It might be a small business owner facing gentrification. They all work together and try to create this place that is, you know, there are issues and there are challenges. It's not a utopia, but trying to create a place that is a little bit of a picture of what America can be at its best. And I'm starting to feel lately that when you don't have much hope up top, that's when you dig in at the very bottom. And In Jackson Heights shows us everyday Americans, real Americans, who are doing that. And it's just, it's a very hopeful picture for me.
Wow. Great pick.
It's a great film. No, it's a great film.
Yeah.
It's a great film. It's also, it's whatever Donald Trump's New York is, this is not it.
Yeah, very, I mean, you're, the, you're right. It is, yeah, it's yeah, the opposite.
Yeah, he should, there's a long list of movies he should see, and that would be one of them.
That's a different top five.
Yeah, I like that.
For another day. So, following Josh there, I guess, and talking about getting the job done, I wanted to focus for my list on movies that weren't about remarkable achievements, not about human beings overcoming great obstacles. That's just not really the type of inspiration I'm looking for right now. So some movies that I love that aren't going to be on my list, Man on Wire, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, mm-hmm. The Right Stuff. The closest I have to that is my number five pick, and I'm looking at my notes here. I have a tie, actually. It's Forrest Gump and Slumdog Millionaire. I don't know how I'm going to explain this one.
Sing Street runner-up.
Whoopsie daisy.
So it's actually a movie from 2015, and it is The Martian, the Ridley Scott film.
Yeah.
It's an outlier on my list because the other four I'm going to get to are all movies that have been discussed in detail on the show and would probably be among my top 25 or 50 movies that are my favorites that we've talked about on the show over the years. This would not be quite that high. It wouldn't really be in the running, but damn it, if it isn't the movie that best captures my state of mind right now. And it's not a true story like those other ones I mentioned, so it's not an actual astounding human achievement overcoming those insane obstacles, but it does work. And I think it works because so many people of different races and nationalities, they come together to pull it off and come together to cheer it on, this return of a man stuck on Mars. It's a unifying event. So that has a feel-good element to it. But more than that, I love how Mark Watney, Matt Damon's character, tackles the problem, that little problem of being stuck on Mars, no way to communicate to NASA or his crew, a crew that doesn't even know that he's actually still alive. He just starts trying to solve the problem one step at a time. What do I eat? What do I drink? How do I survive? And he builds from there. So if it's not clear already, we'll get this out of the way with my first pick here. The election did not go the way I hoped it would. And as I watched, and I was the last guy at my table at the bar going through Kubler-Ross's five stages of grief, I did land on acceptance, just like Watney does, but not resignation. It was more about resolve. I was just determined, as I was watching, to try to make some kind of difference in the world and not try to solve all of the world's problems, just pick one and try to solve it and see if I can actually have an impact on any one issue. And after I actually have time to sit down with my wife and my kids and decide what that issue is that we can tackle collectively as a family, I'll let you all know on the show. Maybe you can join in. Maybe if you want to suggest an issue, I'm all ears. You can even use hashtag FilmSpottingLive, but The Martian's my number five.
All right. That's excellent.
Michael.
And number four is Ratatouille, another film I've and there's a lot of reasons I find, you know, a great deal of hope in that. I think there's a couple. That's a happy ending that I just think is so kind of hard won. It's a completely unexpectedly beautiful story about what it takes to kind of grow up, defy your parents, and still actually persuade them in the end that what you're doing is the right thing, even if you're just a rat who wants to be a haute cuisine chef, right? And there's, you know, I've said this every time it always comes back to this in the live shows too, guys, with the composer Michael Giacchino is my favorite composer in Hollywood right now, and that music in Ratatouille would be, if you honestly just took C-SPAN footage of, you know, Trump's latest appointees and put Giacchino's music on it, you'd be crying, okay? And that's how I feel about the last 5 minutes of that film. I think it's one of the most satisfying happy endings of anything I've seen. It gave me a true sense of kind of hope if you sort of see it through not just the kids' eyes, because it's, you know, a G-rated Pixar film, but I mean, that's the most sophisticated high comedy I've seen in 10 years, you know, of any type. And I adore that film. And for the same reason, I like the film Up a slight bit less than Ratatouille, but the music in that is another one that just sort of lifts you right past every one of your current problems in life. I don't know. I love it. And I don't usually have that kind of direct emotional response to... I don't usually cry about anything unless it falls on me. And more truthfully, I tend not to cry at the movies or any kind of fictional setting at all unless things are going very right for a character, not when they're going wrong, because I think it's very easy to make people cry by throwing peril, adversity, tragedy at the characters in false ways. And that's the kind of like upper happy ending that I just, you know...
Have you actually talked to Giacchino before?
Yeah, I've talked to Giacchino, yeah.
Have you? Yeah. How did it go? Did it live up to
great.
Your...
He had the greatest description of I've ever heard about what a composer does for the movies. He says, my dad was a tailor. I make suits for movies. That's what he said. And that's what a great musical score can do. So, yeah, that's my number four.
Yeah, Ratatouille is great. Probably top of the Pixar for me, Ratatouille, up there.
Really?
Yeah,
number
for sure.
Yeah. Oh, man, what a streak they had.
Number four for me is Tangerine, which is last year's Golden Brick winner. We had a voicemail that might come up later, but about this list in advance from Vanessa from Westchester, and she talks about her list, her picks, and mentioned how she looked for movies that revealed human connection and kindness particularly. And I think that's exactly what we have here in Tangerine, and maybe in the most unlikely of places. It takes place over the course of Christmas Eve night on the streets of Hollywood where a pair of transgender prostitutes are working. So there's a lot of harshness and ugliness here. What Alexandra and Cindy, played by Maya Taylor and Kitana Kiki Rodriguez, what they face as they're negotiating their lives on the streets is really harsh. But there's also beauty, especially in the bleary cinematography, that comes out in unexpected ways, and also this beauty of human connection that that Vanessa mentioned. That finale of Tangerine for me, where Alexandra and Cindy have retreated to this laundromat after Cindy's been jeered on the street by a bunch of bros, it turns on this really remarkable gesture of hope and consolation from Alexandra. And for those of you who haven't seen it, I'm not going to go into details because I don't want to give that away. But shame on you if you're Film Spine listeners and you haven't seen Tangerine yet. This ending, I think, is a courageous example of what you'd probably call being a good bystander. And I'm borrowing some language there from the anti-bullying program that my kids learn at school. I think being a good bystander is something we're all going to need to be in the next 4 years. So when I see something like that enacted in Tangerine, certainly gives me hope.
Great movie, great choice. One I definitely thought about. I'm going to mention Vanessa in Winchester, New York as well, her voicemail, and I'm trying to lay some mainstream ground here before I get to my top three picks. They're going to get pretty art house, but this is another 2015 film at number four, and I thought I was going to be so cheeky with this pick and come up with something that was a little bit offbeat, and then Vanessa did send in this voicemail, and I'll list real quick her top five. She had at number five, Nebraska; number four, Harold and Maude; number two, Magnolia; her number one was Lord of the Rings, Return of the King. Her number three is my number four, and Josh, you're absolutely right. She really eloquently stated that idea that's really the central theme for my whole top five list about human connection and kindness. That's the spirit that I'm really trying to embrace right now with this list and in life in general. So my number four, her number three, and this is a choice that I'm not picking because I actually think we're heading for the apocalypse, but it's Mad Max Fury Road. First off, if you want a thrilling distraction, obviously this is it. But aside from that visual spectacle, which is wonderful, since we first reviewed it on the show, Josh, I've harped on how it's ultimately a movie about power, how it's wielded by the powerful to oppress the powerless, and then it is, at the end, a story of hope and redemption, and not just in how we see the powerless fight back against those oppressors, but within the central characters as well. Think about Tom Hardy's Max and Furiosa, Charlize Theron. They initially see each other as obstacles, trying to prevent them from achieving their end goals, and they come to work together as well and help each other to survive and to help those other people who really desperately need them. It just might also be the perfect revenge metaphor for this election season too, where we get to watch a collection of women topple a misogynistic tyrant. So on that, Michael, you're number three.
I appreciate all the, as we all know, I think all the sentiments about kindness and upstanding or bystanding, you know, if we see it. But we should point out, if anyone hasn't seen Michael Shannon's interviews this week about on RogerEbert.com and also I think IndieWire, and he is full of the most memorable vitriol about who won this election. And my favorite line that I can say without offending too many people is, the interviewer said, "So what do I tell my parents if they voted for Trump and I didn't like it?" He says, "You tell them you're an orphan now." I had to say it.
So, Michael, actually, I'm going to stop you real quick because Sam and I had planned originally at this point in the show to maybe try to get a little bit of listener involvement. Sam, are you out there?
I'm right here.
Okay, Sam is right there. He's always just right there for me. That's how this works over 11 plus years. So, Sam, do you have anything that you would like to share?
I've got a few. So these are your picks. Some of you, many of you, likely in the audience. I don't know how else anybody else would do this. So we're looking for movies that console and restore hope. Taylor Cole. Taylor?
Right here.
Hello, Taylor. Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Ah. Yeah.
Consoles and restores hope. We revel in the beauty of a world we don't understand. Come on up.
Yeah, Taylor, yeah. Didn't you speak at our rap party, too?
I might have, yeah.
You might have. You're a regular. Go.
Yeah, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, particularly that last 20 minutes when we're looking at, you know, a situation that we can't possibly fathom and comprehend. We just sort of have to give in and look for some sort of abstract beauty in whatever small outcroppings of Wyoming we can find.
Love it. Great film.
Thank you,
Taylor.
Thank you. One more? Should we do one more?
Sure.
All right. And I'm not sure if this is comfort food or a movie to restore hope and console. Kino Kabir, at Kino Kabir? Yeah. Do you want to? Are these top five? You want to talk about one of these? We've got In the Mood for Love.
Oh, okay. We're good.
A Serious Man and Meet John Doe. Do you want to share your thoughts on any one of those?
Sure.
Introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Kabir.
It's just movies. They present a scenario in which the world doesn't make a lot of sense, but people keep going on. Especially Meet John Doe, which is an underseen Frank Capra movie, so which it's very irrelevant now. So yeah.
Thank you. All right, let's hear it.
Thanks to those audience members for sharing their picks on Friday night. The top five movies that console and restore hope continues when we come back live from the Chicago Podcast Festival. Stay with us.
Left my home in North Augusta at the age of three. My mother, three brothers, two sisters, and me. She brought us to New York City to set herself free from all the fighting, screaming, and misery. But New York in 1960, no peace to be found. Segregation, guns, and violence was all around. But I'm still here. I'm still here. Yeah. All the things
Josh and Adam, this is Vanessa from Westchester, New York. I usually make my own mental top fives along with you guys, but I wanted to call in for this one, my top five movies that inspire hope, because seeing Josh's tweet and making this list was really helpful to me over the past couple of days. When I started thinking about it, I didn't want just feel-good movies, even though some can be very inspirational. Instead, I found myself drawn towards movies where bad things happen, whether they're cataclysmic or mundane, or people just don't know how to look forward, but in the end, something sparks that courage or optimism or whatever it is that we need. And I find in my list that something is almost always human connection and kindness. So top five movies that inspire hope. Number five, Nebraska. Number four, Harold and Maude. Number three, Mad Max Fury Road. Number two, Magnolia. And number one, Lord of the Rings, Return of the King. And as an honorable mention, just because the hope is so, so far at the end, just the very last shot of the movie, but 28 days later. Anyway, thanks for the show. Can't wait to hear the next one, and keep up the work, good work, guys. Bye.
Our thanks to Vanessa from Westchester, New York, for that great voicemail, which we referenced a couple times there in the first half of the live show at Shuba's on Friday night. Her point about human connection and kindness is one that will continue to resonate as we get through the rest of the top five. Before we go back to Shuba's Tavern and our Chicago Podcast Festival live show, a note for our Chicago listeners. We do have several advanced screening opportunities currently available, not just advanced screening passes, but during run of engagement for some movies as well. They've already opened, but you can see them for free if you do get those passes. And we love being able to offer these free passes to our listeners. It's rare that we have as many opportunities as we do right now, though.
Busy time of year for big movies, and we have chances for you guys to check out a number of them. Ang Lee's Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk is one of them. Nocturnal Animals, this is the Tom Ford film starring Jake Gyllenhaal and Amy Adams. We also have passes for Bleed for This, that features Miles Teller as a boxer. And then Miss Sloan is the Jessica Chastain drama that will be out soon. Visit filmspotting.net for more information about all of those opportunities.
Now let's get back to Shuba's with Michael Phillips and his number three movie that consoles and restores hope.
My number three, I don't think enough people know this film. It's from South Korean director Lee Chang-dong. It's called Poetry. Has anyone seen that here? See it. It's a. For me, it really proves that hope can kind of thrive in even the most difficult medical and emotional experiences. It's about this woman who's 66 years old. in a kind of unnamed town in South Korea, works part-time as a maid and caretaker. She's dealing with early onset Alzheimer's. She's also taking a poetry class at the local cultural center. Her daughter's gone. She's raising her grandson, who's a teenager. He's been accused of a sex crime with five other students. The victim subsequently killed herself. And you have this unbelievably charged situation for this woman who is desperately trying to kind of hang on to her wits. Either this woman joins the fathers of the accused boys in paying all this hush money to the dead girl's mother, covering up the scandal, or she has to make a very, very tough decision to not let her grandson off the hook. This does not sound like a redemption and hope movie, but but the resolution and just watching this really remarkable female protagonist, and she runs this movie in a way that so few American films give the chance for any role, you know, any age. Not just, I hate that phrase, strong female character, because that means, that's so generic now, it means nothing, but this is a woman in a situation I've never seen in the movies. And the way this plays out, it gives you this ending that is so emotionally satisfying and yet honest, without just sort of being a happy ending, that it gives me, A, hope for kind of conventional narrative storytelling in the movies, because this is a straightforward, well-made picture with very little visual flourish to it. See the movie. It just gives you a sense of kind of hope for a lot of things, not just rooting interest for this remarkable female protagonist, but just sort of hope in general for telling this kind of story on screen. And yeah, it's great. It's not topical in a way that dates or anything like that. It's wonderful. My favorite film from about 4 years ago, and it didn't find much of an audience here, but you know, that's the case of so many films.
So poetry somehow not part of our contemporary Korean cinema marathon. So
no,
we've got to catch
up
with that.
What the hell were you doing? Were you doing a North Korean cinema?
Well, that might have been a bad choice in retrospect.
Those are terrible movies.
I'm checking the archive here, and I can't find the full review, but I know it was discussed on the show, and that remarkable protagonist, a remarkable performance, Jung Hee-yun, that was my number five performance of that year.
Fantastic.
Probably should have been higher, so I'm with you, Michael.
Great. All right.
So I usually save my cheats for the live shows, Adam. I don't waste them on our regular recording. Uh-huh. So I've got one here at number three. Not one film, three films. It's the Opu trilogy. And for those of you who didn't follow our 2015, I think it was, Satyajit Ray marathon, these movies, they follow a small boy in rural 1920s India from his childhood through his young adulthood, I would say. And it's a life mostly marked by loss and really death, repeated death. Of family members. And yet, you know, speaking of poetry and these heavy themes, somehow when I thought of consoling films, these three came to mind pretty quickly. Of Padre Panchali, I wrote, "It will wreck you, build you up, ennoble you, and leave you in a daze," you know, sort of like life. And I think maybe it's that universality of these movies that makes them feel like a hopeful work of art to me. But I think also it's something to do with another prevailing theme throughout all of these pictures, and that is this idea of resilience, and particularly Opu's resilience. That's probably the defining characteristic of this character from his time as a little boy to when he is a young man. By the time we've watched him grow up to that, we've really come to love him and just been with him through all these things he's endured with resilience. And when you think about it, resilience is, it's just hope in action, right? That's what we're watching when we're seeing a character be resilient through such things. Resilience is hope in action. So the Opu trilogy is 1955's Padre Panchali, 1957's Aparajito, and then 1959's Apur Sansar, also known as The World of Opu. I can't promise you won't cry while you're watching these, but you'll find a little bit of hope too.
I told Sam that Padre Panchali was going to be on your list.
I threw a few more in with it.
You were going to cheat and bust them all out, but I'll allow it because they are that good. And we're going to stick with the marathon theme here as we get to my number three film. It's from our contemporary Iranian cinema marathon, a 1996 film called A Moment of Innocence, directed by, thank you, Mohsen Makhmalbaf. I'm sure you were applauding for Mohsen, not for me probably there, but what's more hopeful than a man trying to learn from a past mistake and to not just suffer for that transgression that he made in his youth or continue to carry the burden in some way, but actually try to transform that transgression through art. And that's what Mach Malbuff does. The story is, and I say story because a lot of these films in that marathon we've talked about are constructs, and you don't know necessarily how much of it is quote-unquote real or not, with people playing themselves or versions of themselves. But when he was 17 years old, he was protesting the Shah's regime, and he stabbed and injured a policeman. He was trying to get his gun, and he did not get the gun, but he did stab him. And then the story is that many years later, almost two decades later, he was casting a film. He was casting non-professional actors, and the policeman showed up to be cast in the film. So he decided to make a movie recreating that old event, the stabbing incident with that policeman, with each of those roles being performed by other people. But obviously, Mach Malbuff directing himself, quote unquote, and the actor, the policeman, Taibbi, coaching his stand-in in this effort to try to reconstruct it and try to understand it, but not only understand it, more significantly, I think, try to get their audience to learn from that mistake. That's where the hope, I think, really comes in, is that their transgression then and their viewing of that transgression through art can hopefully then transfer to the audience. And it's a remarkable movie. Like I said, very hard to pinpoint what exactly is real or not, but the impact of watching that process, that artistic process play out, and watching the characters relive that moment and recontextualize that moment and that impact that it had on their lives, the big thing is really watching how just through that artistic process they shift their perspective, not only on the incident, but on their adversary in that event. So that's real, and it's powerful, and it culminates in a really beautiful, optimistic, healing final freeze frame that it's just powerful.
Sometimes it is that final, you know, what is literally the final shot, the final image that can kind of take a story that you know is about very dark and painful and violent things sometimes, and just give you something new to think about. And in a very different vein, my number what are we got here? Number two saves everything to the last minute too. The Shop Around the Corner, 1940, Ernst Lubitsch. People know You've Got Mail and various other versions of his musicals. She Loves Me in the Good Old Summertime. And this stars James Stewart and Margaret Sullavan. It's based on an old Hungarian play, Parfumery. And it's about, it's a workplace comedy. It's set in a leather goods and toiletry shop in Budapest between the wars. And these two employees bicker in a way that makes you kind of realize right away that they are kind of meant for each other in some screenwriter universe, right? And yet, there's very little sense of a contrivance in this film. It all leads to this moment where you know, the plot being they're both members of this what they used to call Lonely Hearts Club, where they have secret pen pals and they're pouring their hearts out to, you know, dear friend, and they don't know who this is. And of course, they're writing to each other unbeknownst to both of them. And in the meantime, the tension at work is getting worse and worse with these two. And then at the very last minute, where they realize they're about to go off to meet their romantic destiny, they just think it's with somebody else. The Jimmy Stewart character says, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, now that we know each other, what a shame we didn't speak up. And it's a great moment because for that second, you actually forget that, you know, they're about to, you actually believe it enough, and you believe in this sort of romantic missed connection, that 1 second later, or one line of dialogue later, it's like, oh, wait, we're actually writing to each other. And then it's sort of this improbable, fantastic, well-earned, happy ending. And I think it's a great reminder, and this has got nothing to do with modern politics or the political moment we're living in. It's a great reminder to have the nerve to speak up and open your heart to somebody. And, you know, I used to not believe in that shit, but I do now. And I've always loved this film.
Yeah, it's great. Also a Film Spotting Marathon movie. We did our Lubitsch Marathon, and one of the best films.
It's a beaut.
Sure.
It's a beaut.
Yeah.
All right, number two, I'm going with Children of Men. And yeah, it doesn't immediately seem like a hopeful one, right? Another one of those. But yeah, it almost makes you wonder, is 2027 going to come a little early? That's when this film from Alfonso Cuarón is set. It came out in 2006, but it's set in 2027 in England. that's walled itself off from the rest of the world after 18 years of worldwide infertility. So that's caused anarchy, and England shut things down to the point that immigrants coming to Britain are captured and caged in the film. So nothing too consoling there. Why in the world is this on my list? Well, we're headed towards Christmas, season of hope, and Children of Men is my favorite nativity movie. The plot turns, of course, if you've seen it, you know, on the birth of a miracle baby that's born to a refugee played by Claire Hope Ashity, and then follows the efforts of this Joseph-like figure to guide them both to safety. That figure's played by Clive Owen. So yeah, this is mostly pretty bleak. I mean, Cuarón doesn't go for slick sci-fi aesthetics here. He has a very matter-of-fact, grim realism that he brings to the movie. And when hope comes, even when you get it, at the end, that's all it is. It's not a happy ending. It's just hope, which means it's still out there, right, waiting for you. And the movie beautifully, again, we're coming on final shots a little bit, puts it there for you so that you feel like you can almost reach to the screen and grab it, but it keeps it just that far away. And I think that makes it much more potent than, you know, a happy ending might do. So Children of Men is my number two pick.
And an honorable mention for me. So I'm going to set my number two up with a quote, and I may have read this quote when we talked about this film on the show, but this is from the great Roger Ebert. He says, "It is about a time, place, and culture far removed from our own, and yet it connects directly and deeply with our human feelings. It is like a prayer affirming that this is what the cinema can be, no matter how far in our cynicism we may stray." And Josh stole my thunder a little bit and cheated and picked all three of the movies in the Apu trilogy. I would never cheat like that. This is not Nam, there are rules, and I only picked one of them. And my pick is the third film in that trilogy, The World of Apu, because I think about what Roger says there about cynicism. What do we need now more than that? An antidote to our cynicism. And I think that applies to anybody on whatever political affiliation you have at this point in time. We need an affirmation, even if it's just an affirmation of the power of cinema. And Josh set up what the film is about, what the trilogy is about. But at this point in his life, Apu is an aspiring, struggling writer, and he agrees reluctantly to go to a friend's cousin's wedding, and you know, just like you do, he ends up marrying the bride. It happens.
In Iowa, maybe, Adam.
Hey, now.
Here. That's just for your in-laws.
I appreciate it. They appreciate it too. So after it becomes clear that the groom is not going to be fit for marriage, he does end up stepping in. And even though this movie came out in 1959, and even though we talked about it in detail and probably spoiled it on the show, if you haven't seen it, if you haven't listened to those discussions, I don't want to spoil where it goes from there. There is tragedy that follows, but the consolation and the hope comes in and how these characters ultimately deal with that tragedy, how they respond to it. And we get to watch these characters shake off old prejudices, and they embrace new parts of themselves and new parts of the world that they never thought that they would ever embrace, and they struggle and they suffer, and yet they continue to live and they continue to evolve as people. And I think that message is really important. And like I said, it's kind of like Josh's Children of Men pick, and it's hard for me to say go out and watch The World of Apu. It's a fun time. It's maybe not a fun time, but it's incredibly, incredibly romantic, incredibly heartbreaking in the right ways, and I think ultimately in really affirming, really fulfilling ways.
Yeah, what the World of Apu has is that intermediary segment of them just being married that is among the most romantic sections of cinema I've ever seen.
So good.
And it also, I think the hope comes in at that ending where we get this loop all the way around, right, to Padre Panchali, that shows, again, don't want to give anything away, but it shows that Opu's story is not necessarily the end, I guess is one way that it kind of brings us around there.
Well put. We're at our number one pick. Somehow we're doing a taping of Film Spotting and we're not going along. I don't know how this is actually happening, so we are going to wind up here pretty quick with our top choices, but I believe Sam is out there lingering.
Still here.
Wonderful. Thank you. And may have a couple other choices to share.
I do. We got some good ones. Thank you. I first want to point out that Michael Phillips is being trolled from within the room.
It's coming from
tool,
within
tool?
The room.
Is anyone calling him a tool?
Somebody's calling you a tool. No, Joseph Holler, don't run out. Don't do it.
One Iowa joke, and I'm, you know.
I just want to share this. Michael Phillips calls poetry the movie of a sex crime, the feel-good movie of the year. I think he said that verbatim. Feel-good movie of,
did I really say
of the last
year.
10 years.
Of that year.
Of that
it's
year.
Different.
Who remembers 2006 that well? It was a rough year. All right, so yeah. We do have a few others here.
Well,
don't boo. Don't boo. Remember, I said don't boo. You can say anything else, though, to Michael Phillips. Yeah. All right, we've got... I want to hear from Spencer Coily. Coily? You want to come up here? I'll share your picks as you approach the stage. I'll save the best one for last. The Apartment. Let's hear it.
Die Mensch.
Paris, Texas. And Spencer?
Showgirls?
Did Matt Singer get to you? Because that sounds like a Singer pick.
Nope, that's a me pick.
Okay.
Why?
It's about hope.
If we're talking about overcoming obstacles, look
she
no
totally
further than
will.
Nomi Malone. It is the smartest movie I've ever seen. You know, we hear that argument that it's so bad it's good, but I think it's so good that it's good. It is smart, and it is weird. And it's the love of my life. Thank you.
That's beautiful.
Well, how do you argue with that?
No, it's obviously very personal.
I think we're going to call the show Smart and Weird and the Love of My Life. We went with Cinecast.
We went through a lot of names.
Joshua Coons? We've got Royal Tenenbaums. Why? It's so overrated. But okay, let's hear it. You talk about rescues his fame from a sinking battle.
Typo. Twitter typo.
Twitter typo. You explain yourself.
I just feel like that's a film I can always return to. It always, there's parts in it that always make me cry, always make me laugh. And that shot of the gravestone when it says that he rescued his family from the deck of a sinking battleship. He really did rescue his family, and you just realize that this lovable buffoon, goofball, kind of crazy character did what he set out to do in the end. So,
let's finish up, guys. Okay. Number one.
Number one. Adam, you mentioned Antidote to Cynicism, and that's kind of what guided this one. I adore the musical form of musicals, and that's kind of, if there's one thing I'm kind of instinctively craving a little more of right now, it's that. And a lot of it's because it hasn't opened yet, but... La La Land is really something. It's not my pick. Not my pick. But it referenced visually. I love it. And there's actually I'm not sure it's the top three or anything, but the three of the best movies I think I've seen this year, at least three of them, radically different, all have this fascinating mixed, like three notes at once ending. It's a very bittersweet, hard one, kind of happy-ish ending, and that seems right for now. Like, and the films I'm talking about are Manchester by the Sea, which has nothing to do with La La Land, which has nothing to do with Moonlight, which many probably have already seen Moonlight, I hope. I mean, those are resonant happy endings that feel like they're kind of made by adults for adults. It's not the usual... sort of, you know, settle for less movie experience anyway. But in La La Land, there's an awful lot of visual referencing back to probably one of my favorite musicals, Vincent Minnelli's The Bandwagon, 1953. That's my number one. It's, if you haven't seen it, it's not as well known as the one I usually kind of reel off as my favorite musical, Singing in the Rain. You know, no surprise, it's a lot of people's favorite. This came 1 year later. It's kind of a mellower, more bittersweet kind of tale about a guy, an aging Broadway hoofer played by Astaire, who's basically on the outs, goes back to Broadway to kind of reinvigorate his career, and he's thrown in with this cockamamie high art musical project with the ballerina played by Sid Charisse. And it's really kind of just how this makeshift collection, this motley collection of talents, learns to work as a family. And it's the old showbiz parable that every showbiz, every movie project, every Broadway attempt, you know, in the movies especially, they become a surrogate family. Well, this is a time, I think, this is a time for all of us where we kind of are going to be looking to make and strengthen every community, every family unit, everything we have, this is the time to really work on it and find all the new ones we can and strengthen the one we have. And oddly enough, that's what comes to mind when I think about this film. It's also just because it's all this stuff is activated by, you know, fantastic song and dance and a film by one of the greatest camera stylists, one of them anyway, America ever put out. So for a lot of reasons, I adore it, and the movie gives me hope. And the song That's Entertainment comes from it, among other things. And I'll always remember That's Entertainment because at the Cannes Film Festival, when Lars von Trier's Antichrist was screened, not a film for hope or renewal. It ended with, after all the mutilation and death and bleeding, lights come up. The audience looks like the Nazis at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark. And Manola Dargis from the New York Times jumps up and says, and they say as they go on their way, that's entertainment. And that was, it was a great moment in screening history. And it wouldn't have been possible without the bandwagon.
I don't know. Michael, Chaos Reigns does seem appropriate. Yeah, right about
that's right.
Now. But I do just want to throw out a teaser for everyone. If you enjoyed hearing what Michael was just explaining, there will be at some point in the pretty near future a Minnelli marathon on the show. So everyone will get their musicals education. We might let Michael come on the show for that.
I never get him off. Never get him off again.
All right, number one for me is going to be Lincoln. Steven Spielberg's Lincoln.
Sure.
Now,
ooh,
is that anger? Was that anger?
We got some Stephen Douglas fans in the audience tonight.
It kind of built. Like, at first I was hearing it, I thought, okay, I think that's appreciative, and then it got more of a growl, and I got concerned. I'm going to proceed anyway. My date with Hamilton is next month, so...
The poll question, the results came in. We can't talk about Hamilton anymore.
Too late. Okay. I didn't see those results. But just from listening so far to the cast recording, I think that it works much like Lincoln did, taking this... It really reinvigorates crucial American history in a way that is relevant now, makes it resonant now. And I think that's what Spielberg was doing here with Lincoln, which dramatizes the passage of the 13th Amendment, which, of course, abolished slavery in the waning days of the Civil War. Now, the movie details in, you know, really nitty-gritty details, but still makes it suspenseful what Lincoln had to do to pass this legislation, the politicking, the negotiating. And I think in watching that, and I felt this even, I think, Michael, you liked this movie a lot more than I did initially. Thank you. I think, like, even then, though, I did appreciate how it sort of made clear to me that the U.S. is built on these, they're gears that can, okay? If they're operated well, these are gears that can grind towards justice. That doesn't mean it always happens. It doesn't mean it happens as soon as it should happen, but the possibility is there. And I think that Lincoln documents that for us. I think Lincoln also gives us a little bit of perspective, which might be helpful now as well. As terrible as things may seem to many of us, we're not facing what the country did then, though. I think we can all agree on that. And I think understanding that and getting that perspective, again, will point a way forward. I think we can recognize that maybe we've squandered some of what was won in what Lincoln documents. But at the same time, the movie still gives us hope that gives us something of a roadmap, even maybe, of ways that we can regroup and recover. And at least, you know, that's my hope at this moment.
Hey, you can't argue with that, even if you don't like Lincoln. And I don't, really. So thank you, everyone who agrees with me on that. My number one is The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp from Powell and Pressburger.
All right.
I just thought, at a time when we're all asking, now what, why not watch the travails of a character at a crossroads in his life, even if it's pretty late in his life, asking that same question, General Clive Candy. It's World War II. It's set in the mid-40s, and it was made in that same time period. And it has this amazing perspective where it flashes back. Now he's an old, stodgy, out-of-touch general, but back in the Boer War and then on to World War I, that was not the case. And we get that whole sweep. We get this important historical perspective that sets this one tragic series of events, that terrible war, of course, set against those other events. And I think that's useful now, but the real reason I love this movie, there's a couple reasons why I thought it was important for this list and why it's my number one. It does feel like we're in the midst of a sort of war right now, an ideological war, and because they show us how this movie fits within this sweep of history, as I said, I think it maybe does provide something useful. But beyond that, there's a quote at one point, and if I had a clip, if we could play it, I'd play about 12 from this movie. But a character at one point says to Clive, "Do you remember we used to say our army is fighting for our homes, our women, and our children? Now the women are fighting beside the men. The children are trained to shoot. What's left is the home. But what is the home without women and children?" So taking the gender politics out of that for a moment, what stands out to me there is the fear that a paradigm has shifted. And again, I'll say lots of people feel that that's shifted regardless of what side you were on in the election, that somehow this country has lost its way. So the movie taps into that, but really getting back to the idea of a little bit of comfort food, there are few performances and few characters who delight me as much as Roger Livesey and Anton Walbrook in this film. And Anton Walbrook is the actor who says those lines, Theo Kretschmar Schildorf. He's a German. He's his opponent. He's his adversary. They actually begin their friendship because they're in a duel. And they are, of course, fighting on opposite sides of the war. And yet, it's one of the most moving and profound depictions of friendship that I can think of in cinema. And it's not as if they come together despite their differences and then everything's ironed out and they're the best of friends who also agree on everything the rest of their lives. They actually continue to have fundamentally different views of the world and how war should be fought. And yet, there's a fundamental underlying respect to that friendship and a rationality between them. And right now, I need to believe that that's still possible. So The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp is the movie I'm going to turn to give me that hope.
Right. It's a fairy tale, but it's a terrific one. It is.
Those are our top five. I'm sure we have a few honorable mentions. Thank you. Michael, Josh, any films that you haven't had a chance to mention yet?
And we got enough white men up here to kind of deal with it. But if you, for a lot of reasons, I think you picked the Apu trilogy. You know, Linklater's Boyhood to me feels like something that's even more pertinent now. I think just to kind of see what you can kind of get through as an mm-hmm. ordinary human being, and hopefully land at a place when you're really beginning your continuing education that you can also call just life, you know, at age 18, whatever you're doing, whoever you are, if you can land with both feet more or less on the ground like this wonderful character is, I just think that in this age of also binge watching, this is kind of the opposite. You know, it's not, you're not spending easy 53 minute chunks with one. It's really more about living in this time stream that I just so rarely see in movies, where you have a film that's, well, how long? What's the running time on Boyhood? 3?
It sounds like
tick under 3 hours. But this idea that, you know, the simple fact of it being shot over that many years with the same actors, it just gave it a whole different feeling of kind of wonder and delight, you know. And even though that film, I think, was almost praised to the point of people going in with kind of a show me attitude by the time a lot of the reviews came out, I think the press almost killed that film in advance just because it was, you know, burdening it with all this baggage about greatness and, you know, what's, and the movie has hardly any moving parts you can even point to, like yeah, that's a melodramatic plot turn, it's not like that. It's more like, I like that. That's the one I wish I'd had room for.
Yeah, a few other titles, and some of these may have been suggested on Twitter. We saw a great Great number of good suggestions there. But you talked about soundtracks sometimes doing the work of instilling hope. And for me, I love Beasts of the Southern Wild, as listeners know, for many reasons. But that music alone is the sound of hope for me. I also thought about Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and then thought about it a little more. And in some ways, it's Lincoln-like, you know, and its belief in the system. But then there are other ways it's completely subverting that and suspicious of the system. So that's one that could maybe go in either direction. And also, Charlie Chaplin's The Immigrant. I mean, this is, you know, it's 1917, and it's just a reminder that we've always been from somewhere else. And so that, you know, it's sometimes helpful to take a historical, you know, that film is good Chaplin, but it's also, as a historical document, I think really valuable.
Everybody here at Shoebiz has done an amazing job putting on the show tonight, and somehow they didn't get the electronic buzzer set up to get you every time you mentioned Beasts of the Southern Wild. I thought that was in the writer, and yet...
Got to get that installed on your computer.
Yeah, we need to work on that. So, mentioned Children of Men, Josh's choice. A couple obvious, but I still think good picks for this list. It's a Wonderful Life, The Shawshank Redemption, and Melissa Taminga, who is part of our Film Spotting Advisory Board. They help us out with ideas for top five lists and give us some great suggestions as well. You've heard her on the show, a great critic writing in the Pacific Northwest. She talked about Swiss Army Man on the show with me. She had three movies that are great choices and that are all in the Film Spotting pantheon. All the President's Men. This is Melissa's words: the truth will out, hope for journalism, hope that the truth will remain something we value. The Wizard of Oz, we'll find our way home in the end. And then The Tree of Life, actually not in the pantheon yet, is it? Sam, we need a ruling
on
this.
It's gotta be.
Did we put it in? Oh man, not currently. Well, we're gonna rectify that, but help each other, love everyone, every leaf, every ray of light, forgive. Not in the pantheon, but a couple films, three films here actually that are in my penalty box currently, or debt. Carl Theodore Dreyer, Knights of Cabiria from Fellini and Sullivan's Travels. Hmm. And I think that's it. I think we've done it. How do you guys feel about it?
Well, I think the band's about ready to come out, okay. So we better.
We're going to wrap up. We do want to say our thanks to everyone here at Shoebiz, to Tyler Green, to Jonathan Pitts, everyone involved with the Chicago Podcast Festival. I mentioned the Film Spotting Advisory Board, Candace Griffiths, our associate producer, and of course, the great Sam Van Halgren, everybody. Sam and Golden Joe Dassault also in the house. Let's give him a round of applause.
Golden Joe.
Because you know that without Sam and Golden Joe, this show doesn't go. And of course, thanks to Michael Phillips. It's still a thrill every time he comes on the show. We knew doing a live show, we had to bring the big guns on, and you didn't disappoint. So thank you, Michael.
Fellas, I'm speechless.
And we do have another live show in January that's part of WBEZ's Podcast Passport. We're going to do our 2016 Rap Party. Tickets are actually on sale for that right now. What did I say? Any other comments from the crowd here? All right, everybody. That's it. Good night.
Thank you, everyone.
Guys, thanks for coming up.
It was supposed to be a 60-minute set, Josh, and for once we actually hit the clock. I think we were...
I still don't know how that happened.
We were in just under or just at the wire. We hope everyone enjoyed listening to that as much as we did putting on the show. And of course, one of the big treats is not only having that back and forth with the crowd and being able to play off the live crowd and the energy a little bit, but getting to meet listeners afterwards as well is always a treat. Some of them we've seen at multiple live shows. I think of someone like Mary Kravanaugh, who I don't know that I've seen her before, but she mentioned that she's come to other shows, and I see her name in our mailbag all the time, and she said she started listening around episode 10.
Wow.
So that really is going back to basically to like May or June 2005, and that's pretty remarkable that she stuck with us that long.
Yeah, I got to talk to Mary a little bit, had a good conversation with her as well afterwards, and also saw Rosalie Messer, a familiar name to listeners. She writes in to the show quite a bit, so that was good to hang out at Shoebiz afterwards. It was overall, I would say, you know, a more relaxed live show than the big January rap party we put
That's
on.
A good
Less
point.
Production details were involved. So maybe it wasn't as big of a show, but the whole vibe in the room was more of like a hangout, I would say, and that continued afterwards. So
yeah, it felt right for that space, and we did approach it. Maybe that's one of the reasons why I was so relaxed on stage. I don't know that I have actually been so relaxed before at any of our live shows, because we usually are thinking about different video cues and audio cues, and we're cutting between different segments. And we deliberately said, okay, we only have 60 minutes. Let's make sure we've stripped this down a little bit. It's going to be a little bit boring, for lack of a better word, for listeners to just watch three of us on stage talking. I mean, we really are just recording a podcast, but hopefully the conversation was stimulating enough.
If you do want all those fireworks, though, the videos, the music, we are going to have that in January at the rap party. January, I should have this in my head now.
The pyrotechnics, they're going to happen at the rap
fireworks.
Party.
Is it the 11th? Is that what
no,
we're
No,
it's
at? The 13th.
Okay,
Friday, January 13th.
Now that I just put the wrong date in everyone's heads. Friday, January 13th will be the rap party. Now, before we get ahead of ourselves, if you have any comments about the picks we shared on this show, ours or Michael's, please send those to feedback@filmspotting.net.
Or let us know your picks. We'd love to hear your number one.
Yeah, keep those healing and restoring movies coming. Voicemails are always appreciated. Those can be sent to 312-264-0744. That number is under the About Us tab at filmspotting.net. We are on Facebook, of course, and Twitter. On Twitter, Adam's at filmspotting. I'm at Larson on Film.
Also at filmspotting.net is where you can find 11 years of reviews, interviews, and top fives in the show archives. And if you haven't already, please check out the Film Spotting family of podcasts. All those shows performed at the podcast festival, The Next Picture Show, and Film Spotting SVU. You can find both in iTunes or your podcast app of choice. Opening wide this weekend, one movie that's already been out on Wednesday, Allied, the World War II thriller starring Brad Pitt and Marion Cotillard, directed by Robert Zemeckis. Bad Santa 2 is out. Moana is out, and Rules Don't Apply. This is Warren Beatty's first directing gig since 1998's Bullworth. It's set in 1958. He plays Howard Hughes. Alden Ehrenreich, one of the performers playing a newcomer there to Hollywood, and of course he was so good in Hail Caesar from the Coen brothers earlier this year.
I can give a quick recommendation to Moana, the Disney animated musical. Maybe we'll find time in the next episode to give it a few more seconds, but the music is great. Lin-Manuel Miranda, of course, involved in some of that. The animation is gorgeous, and Dwayne Johnson, The Rock, is a lot of fun.
He's always entertaining.
Yeah, and it's the perfect part for him to voice. So this is a good one.
Out in limited release, this is one that should be right in my wheelhouse. And in fact, it so much is in my wheelhouse that I'm terrified to see it. Coming Through the Rye, set in 1969, a sensitive 16-year-old adapts J.D. Salinger's book as a play so he can play Holden Caulfield, and the long-awaited, by so many cinephiles, Manchester by the Sea, Kenneth Lonergan's latest, Casey Affleck and Michelle Williams star in that film. Next week on the show, we are probably, unfortunately, not going to be able to get to a full review of Manchester by the Sea, but we are discussing a few things behind the scenes. There has been some talk about Tom Ford's Nocturnal Animals, but right now I think we are leaning towards The Edge of 17, the movie starring Hailee Steinfeld that has been getting a lot of good buzz, a lot of critical acclaim, even though it maybe isn't doing so great at the box office, which is even more reason for us to probably give it some time.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. For our music this week, we've been playing some songs by the late Sharon Jones. She died just this November 18 at the age of 60 due to complications from pancreatic cancer. This journey and her struggle was chronicled in the recent documentary Miss Sharon Jones. I saw it at Toronto in 2015.
Barbara Koppel.
Yeah, it's
great.
It's pretty strong with some amazing, as you might expect, musical numbers. So that is worth seeking out, especially now to remember the work of Sharon Jones. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.